Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. In Pakistan, some religious clerics use the Quran as justification for strict legal codes. In her latest book, Pakistan's Blasphemy Laws, From Islamic Empires to the Taliban, Shamim Birney Abbas argues that blasphemy laws are neither Islamic nor do they represent the Prophet Muhammad's own vision. Having herself been persecuted, she says, in her native Pakistan, she is now Associate Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies at SUNY Purchase in Westchester. Professor Abbas, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
Tell us your story. How did the blasphemy laws in Pakistan affect you?
Well, in the sense that in 1998, when I was professor and chair of the Department of English Language and Applied Linguistics at the Open University in Islamabad, I was charged with blasphemy by the functionaries at the university, including the vice chancellor himself. And the charges against me were that I had spoken derogatory remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, and that I had said the Quran was an outdated book and that it should be put away in a cupboard, which were fabricated charges. I never said anything like that, but this was a way to intimidate me. And
were you saying other things that they wouldn't have liked?
No, I was not. I think mainly it was my work in Sufism, women's voices in Sufism, my published work on Sufism, my PhD on speech, play, and verbal art in the Indo-Pakistan oral Sufi tradition.
And you did your PhD here in the United States at the University of Texas.
Yes, I did. So basically, I think the clerical administration at the university were afraid that having returned with the PhD from the United States, I would be perhaps the future vice chancellor of the university. And they wanted to stop that because just to go back into the history of how these clerics came to run the university, not only the Open University, but most of the universities in the country were that during the Afghan War, when we were fighting the Soviets through CIA and Pakistan's military intelligence.
Oh, that Afghan War. The Afghan War in the 1980s against the Soviet Union.
Exactly. So we had to create, through General Ziaul Haq, a core of so-called ulema or scholars of Islam who would validate the Islamization of Pakistan. And so these clerics from the madrasas who just did not have any education or anything, diplomas or whatever they were, you know, were validated through the rubber stamping processes of the University Grants Commission. And they were given equivalences and everything. And I have talked about it in my book on Pakistan's blasphemy laws from Islamic empires to the Taliban, how they were made the ulama or the scholars of Islam when really, you know, these were clerics from the madrasas.
And so they have a gender-based agenda to some degree to keep women from getting educated.
Absolutely, very largely. And although in Afghanistan they just went outright against the women, they eliminated women professionals from the academy, from the medical profession and everything. And now we've seen it happen in the SWAT also, where they are against women's education. At that time in 1998, a very pernicious but subtle process was happening by eliminating women from the academy. And there were very many senior women scholars and heads of department at the Open University. So they were being systematically eradicated.
And yet, wasn't the initial blasphemy claim against you made by a woman?
Yes. Thanks for reading the book. I think, you know, she just played into their hands. They were using these junior faculty who were working in my department against me. They were using younger women to challenge my scholarship, to challenge my professorship.
But does it indicate that there's much woman-to-woman buy-in on the whole Madras-oriented point of view?
You know, this is it's a very complex process, Brian. What they have done is these clerics and the clerical administration and this Talibanized administration that I call in Pakistan at the moment, they have brought in a lot of women on board with them through indoctrination or through another school of thought, which is very radicalized. And at the moment, there seem to be two streams in Pakistan, a very radical secular stream among women and also a very radicalized stream of women who have been trained to propagate this kind of very radical version of Islam.
I wonder if anybody else is listening. We could take a few phone calls, maybe others of Pakistani descent or Afghan, who have been through anything similar or know anybody who's been through anything similar or want to react to our guest, Professor Shamin Bernie Abbas from SUNY at Purchase in Westchester County and author now of Pakistan's Blasphemy Laws from Islamic Empires to the Taliban, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And for some of our Muslim listeners, is this even, as you understand it, what Muhammad the Prophet decreed in any way? 212-433-9692. And that's another aspect of the book. You call some of these laws a full-blown larceny of Muhammad's Islam. And yet those who uphold them cite Muhammad as the source of origin.
I don't think so. That's not true. And I'm talking about Muhammad's own relationship with his consorts in the book, and that many of the verses in the Quran were revealed because Muhammad's wife, women like Umm Salama and others, wanted Muhammad to talk about women's rights. And there are many verses in the Quran that uphold the rights of women. The Quran speaks to many occasions and to many instances supporting women. I'll quote an instance. For instance, the law of evidence that has been built into Pakistan's hudood laws. Because you see, my book is dealing mainly with blasphemy laws, but the subtext is also about the hudood laws that Ziaul-Haq brought on board. Reducing a woman's testimony to one half, and also in case of fornication, a woman had to produce four male adult Muslim witnesses to prove her violation, and if she could not, she was charged with zina or fornication, which meant, you know, a woman could not report it.
So these extreme laws are called the Hudud Ordinances, and they were brought in during the regime of President Ziaul-Haq.
Absolutely.
Which was what years?
This was between 1978 to 1989 when he was alive. But, you know, successively, articles continue to be added to these hudud laws. And there is nothing of the kind in the Quran where these kinds of punishments are recommended against women. So
how do you think it got lost in translation over the centuries?
I think, you know, that's what my research is showing. What happened was these Muhammad, frankly speaking, was either governing through revealed law, you know, like his revelations and things, or through the customary laws of the region. There is no mention of a blasphemy in the Quran. If there was, we would know about it. Muhammad never killed anybody for blasphemy. The only reference to blasphemy is about the Trinity in the Quran, that you cannot talk about the Trinity, that, you know, God.
The Christian Trinity?
The Christian Trinity. But even then, Muhammad did not challenge Mary's birth or anything of the sort. In fact, Christ is mentioned at least 70 to 80 times in the Quran, and there is a verse that is called the verse of Mary in the Quran, Surah Maryam, that is recited to women in childbirth. And so he was not against that idea, but the idea that most Muslims will not accept is the fact that, you know, God had a son.
Ali in New Haven, you're on WNYC with Professor Abbas. Hello, Ali.
Hi. I have a simple question. Thank you, Professor. Could you elaborate exactly who funds these madrasas? And where exactly is this strict interpretation of Islamic thought coming in from? Where is the funding coming for these kind of institutions? I think that's an important focus, and we should try to pinpoint that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ali, for asking that question. I think a large part of this funding from the madrasas are coming from Saudi Arabia, which is trying to export its very militant version of Islam, which is Wahhabi Islam. But it started in 1978-77, when General Zia-ul-Haq was instituted in the region to bring down the Soviet Union, and, you know, with the Pakistani military and the inter-services intelligence. The questions that I'm asking in my book are, and I would not like to accuse any agency, but it started out with the CIA funding the madrasas and creating this very diehard kind of a jihadist ideology, because we needed an ideology to go into Afghanistan to bring down the Soviets, you know, who are the communists. So we gave it the cover of a Sharia, and I challenge strongly that this is not a Sharia. This is not Muhammad's Sharia. This is not coming from the Quran. This is a Sharia that was generated by General Zia-ul-Haq and the Islamic political parties that were around him.
So most Muslims, you'd probably say, around the world would not support these extreme kinds of laws. What's the path to getting them undone in Pakistan?
Well, I'll answer your first question, Brian, you know, that, you know, most Muslims around the world do not support this kind of an Islam. Yes, they do not, because 99.99% of the Muslim world is very peaceful. People mind their own business. Religion is a very private affair of individuals. And Islam would not have been such a widespread religion had it not the capability to integrate with other cultures wherever it went. You know, for instance, in Africa or in Indonesia or Southeast Asia. In fact, during my research and the presentations that I have done for the Purchase community, I have evidence of musical, Sufi musical songs in which the Muslim Africans call upon the Jewish spirits for peace. And also during there's a whole chapter on Muhammad that I have put into this book, because this book has been written for students and for ordinary people. And there's a total chapter on Muhammad. And in an assignment, and I'm talking a lot about Muhammad's relationship with the Jewish tribes of Arabia at that time. And a question that I gave to my class on citizens under Islamic, living under Islamic law, on Muhammad's relationship with the Jewish tribes. The students investigated it, and they came back with the response that Muhammad was not anti-Semitic.
And so, last question, is there a path that you see to getting these extremist laws undone in Pakistan?
I think we can. You know, because I'm sorry to say, but I think I'm speaking the truth. These laws came on board with support from the CIA, with support from Saudi Arabia, with support from the Pakistan's military establishment. I think we can have these laws undone, because the military calls the shot on almost every policy in the country. The military instituted these laws, and they should be asked to remove them, to repeal them.
Shamim Berni Abbas, Associate Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies at SUNY at Purchase in Westchester County, the author of The Female Voice in Sufi Ritual previously, and her new book, Pakistan's Blasphemy Laws from Islamic Empires to the Taliban. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.